Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Hello and welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky and I'm going to be your host for the next, half an hour or so. Wow, it's been a long time since my last podcast. I think the last one was in March of 2007, so it really has been a while. But I'd like to get back on track with the podcasting, start doing it again. Now, make no promises as to how often I will produce these podcasts. I'm not going to make any commitment in terms of frequency. Basically, I'll do them as I can, as time and energy permits. But needless to say, there's a lot of things to talk about. I've got a great back catalog now of Sentient Developments blog posts that I can revisit here and rearticulate in verbal format. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of different things over the next coming weeks and months. Anything to do really with transhumanism and human enhancement, issues that pertain to futurism, artificial intelligence, singularity, things like that. But more so, I think, to issues surrounding bioethics, gender issues, animal welfare issues. That concerns me most certainly. And one of my intense passions for me anyways in terms of contemplation and research involves the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the conundrum known as the Fermi Paradox. And those of you who have listened to my podcasts in the past or who even have even followed my blog, they know they're familiar with that line of inquiry. Other things I like to talk about, again, anything that pertains to human enhancement, human modification, so it can be bodily morphology, changing our bodies, cognitive enhancements, or just simply altering our brains, reproductive alterations, different choices in terms of how we choose to be reproductive agents. Those are definitely all part of the larger transhumanist umbrella. Those are the kinds of issues that we'll talk about. Those are the issues that I like to address, and I did so actually recently. I was asked to speak at the University of Toronto in Mississauga. It was an event hosted by the Mississauga Freethought Association, which is a student group at U of T in Mississauga, and the Halton Peel Humanist Community. And it was wonderful to be invited by these particular groups, and there most certainly appears to be a lot of commonality and a lot of agreement and synergy between transhumanist groups, or at least like-minded individuals with the humanist community and with the more secular-minded people, which there's certainly a strong voice here in Ontario in particular, and very much in particular in the GTA area. And we've collaborated in the past, and it was great to come out and talk to them. So that was last week, the last week of January 2008. And I presented a presentation entitled Cyborgs of the Past, Present, and Future. And I spoke for approximately an hour, had a great slideshow presentation to back me up. And what I did during the presentation was try to, and again, this is kind of my new MO for a whole lot of different things, whether it be blogging or speaking or even the work we're doing with Better Humans, is to root as much of the transhumanist discourse into more real world and more practical and observable, to present that in a way that's more obvious. Because right now, with a lot of the futurism that's in place with transhumanism, it's very intangible. It's out of touch. It's forever out of our grasp. So what I did with this presentation at U of T was discuss a lot of cybernetic applications that exist today or will come into being in the very, very near future, like in the next several years or so, or certainly within the next decade. But I also backtracked a way back and spoke to some of the roots and the proto-transhumanists that existed during the time of the Enlightenment, and that included such thinkers as Condorcet and Diderot. And I'll talk about Condorcet a bit later in this podcast. And so I spoke about everything from dialysis machines and artificial hearts and heart replacement devices or assistive devices, and everything from neuroprosthetics like cochlear implants to deep brain stimulation and the various cybernetic technologies that exist today. So I'm going to take a quick break, and for those of you again who are familiar with my podcast in the past, I like to intersperse my segments with music. Music is a deep, deep passion of mine, and I like to share it with everyone. My recent discoveries and different, themes as they apply to the podcast as well, to kind of give it a mood. So today, before I get into this music, and I don't play too much music, I only play about 30 second to 60 second snippets. It gives us a good break in between the segments. But today what I'd like to talk about, I'm going to talk after the break about deep brain stimulation and what that is, and one of the more recent bizarre discoveries as a result of deep brain stimulation. I'm also going to talk about Condorcet a little bit, Marquis de Condorcet, who I mentioned just earlier, who's a key Enlightenment thinker and a proto-transhumanist. I'm going to talk about Britney Spears, believe it or not, and really about the issue is more about mental health than it is about Britney Spears and our attitudes about mental health. I want to talk about that a little bit. And I think that's going to be about it for today. And time permitting, I'll maybe squeeze another couple of articles in there, but that looks like what we'll do today. So I will see you on the other side of this break. Relatively new and experimental procedure that sounds exactly like what it does. It's a deep brain stimulation. A brain pacemaker is implanted deep into the brain, and it can do a whole number of things, but in particular, it alleviates the symptoms of a number of, I'd say, quite debilitating conditions, including epilepsy, chronic pain, and Parkinson's disease. And it is pretty, while it is effective, at least it's proving to be effective, it can be a rather invasive process to have it done. I was watching, I believe it was Wired Science a number of months ago, and they actually showed a deep brain stimulation procedure taking place. It was done on a man who was suffering from, I believe it was Parkinson's, and he had tremors that were very bad, and the tremors were most pronounced in his hand movements, and they were just shaking back and forth. And in order for the deep brain stimulation procedure to be implemented, the patient typically has to be awake on the operating table and responding to the surgeons. Right now, as it stands, our understanding of brain function and cognitive function down at the cellular level is still pretty medieval, really. We really don't have much of a clue what's happening at very specific localized areas, and we need to have the feedback of the patient to tell us where exactly we are in the brain and where we're operating. So in this case, when they opened up the man's skull and they're drilling deep inside his brain, they needed to know that they were in the area of the brain that was suffering from the impairment, because it's in that area that they will put the brain pacemaker, the electrical stimulants, to alleviate the symptoms. So in this case, they had the man on the operating table, and they were deep into that area, and they were just fiddling around in the various areas of the brain, and they asked him to hold up his hand. And at one point, obviously, well, he had the tremors, but at one point when they were at the right place, the tremors stopped. And once the tremors stopped, they knew they were in the right place. That's where they were able to localize and put in the brain pacemaker. And they sewed him back up, and he was on his way. And it was really, it was nothing short of miraculous. The man couldn't believe it. I was watching it on television. I couldn't believe it. They literally fixed it. They literally fixed the problem. So deep brain stimulation is an incredibly exciting, but like I said, still very experimental and invasive procedure. It's still a bit of a mystery, really, as to why it's working or how it's working. And there was also recent news, and this occurred in Canada, where a patient was being given a deep brain stimulation, and I didn't know this until this particular case, but it's also being used, believe it or not, to suppress eating disorders, or I guess really severe eating disorders, in this case appetite suppression, that might be out of whack at a cognitive level. And the patient that they were working on was morbidly obese, so he most certainly needed this particular procedure done. So what happened, though, in this particular case was quite interesting and quite illuminating, and even in some ways somewhat disturbing, but also leading perhaps to some new potentials for this procedure. While this individual was having the surgery done, and like I mentioned earlier, they are awake, he suddenly had a feeling, and he expressed this to the surgeons, of a profound deja vu, which was quickly after, as the stimulation increased, quickly followed by extremely vivid flashbacks to an event that happened 20 years prior. And the man started to have flashbacks of him at a park and a bright sunny day, and he remembered that exact incident. But then an interesting thing happened. It started to get a little bit more intense, and according to the article that I read, and this was in the BBC, the man actually started to feel that he was actually experiencing those memories again, that he was actually in that time and having that experience again. So it must have seemed very much like a dreamlike state, or even perhaps not even dreamlike. Perhaps he had his temporal sense completely impaired, and he quite literally felt that he was acting in real time as these memories were unfolding. And he remembered again, he was in a park, a very bright sunny day. He even had an ex-girlfriend of his was there with him, and certain events unfolded exactly as it happened that day, and he was very much fully participating in the remembrance of those events. So some of the I guess the pundits are thinking, what does that actually mean, and what are the ramifications of that? And it's pretty staggering. It has potentials, I suppose, for, well, most immediately, it could help in work done for things like Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative disorders. Where Alzheimer's is a problem is in associative memories. And with this particular incident, it would appear that deep brain stimulation can have an impact on how associative memories are, I guess, repaired or remedied, or how those associative memories can be made stronger so that there are those associations. And that really is how memory works. We call up a list of remembrances that we're able to access because we have linkages to those events. Oftentimes, and I think for the vast majority of our memories, we do lose those linkages because so many of those memories are not important. We don't remember the minutiae of each and every thing that we've ever done. And over time, we just simply, because we've forgotten to remember. We've forgotten how to remember. But those memories are still there. And we know they're still there because oftentimes, let's say we come across an old friend who we haven't seen in quite some time. And that friend will bring up an incident from your past, and you'll immediately remember it. And then you'll say to yourself, man, I completely forgot about that. But again, what's interesting and what's profound is that those memories are, though, still intact in your mind. So everything's still in there. Everything's still in that cranium of yours. It's just that you don't know how to access it. The trouble is with a condition like Alzheimer's is that gets more and more severe over time and impaired over time, and your associative memories becomes harder and harder to keep track of and to maintain, such that they're basically gone, particularly some of your more longer-term, and well, but most profoundly the short-term memories just simply don't stick in that way. So yeah, deep brain stimulation is offering a different avenue for the treatment of these sorts of impairments, and look for this to be applied more and more to Alzheimer's, and hopefully this will become less and less experimental over time and more deliberate and more and more, I guess, assured in terms of what we're actually doing in the brain, how and why we're doing those things. And I certainly will look to see if there's any follow-up on this particular issue and if there's any other issues that will arise with similar side effects that involve profound memory recollection like this one here. So yeah, deep brain stimulation, rather exciting, and that's definitely a cybernetic application because we're actually putting so-called brain pacemakers deep into the brain. There's artificial devices that are doing their thing in there, stimulating the areas such that they will operate with greater functionality. And deep brain stimulation. So look for that and definitely over the next coming years. Marquis de Condorcet. I'm wondering how many of you have heard of him. I certainly kind of missed the boat on this guy, and I even studied, had an entire course on the Enlightenment when I was at university. I missed out, I suppose, on some of the more transhumanistic elements that Condorcet had to contribute to the whole, I guess, proto and now current transhumanist discourse. The Enlightenment period, basically the period between 18th century, up until and pretty much including after the French Revolution. And it was a time of great intellectual fervor and a lot of original ideas, a lot of exciting ideas. Much of it was driven by the rise in humanism and secularism, the move away from the church. So rather than deferring to authority and to scripture, these intellectuals, these political scientists, these philosophers, they instead put more weight behind the scientific method and empiricism and, most profoundly, reason, rationality. We can use our minds, they argued, to great effect to not just improve ourselves individually, but most certainly in terms of the application to society and to politics. And as some of these thinkers also went on to say, to the human condition in terms of our biology and our capacities. And again, one such thinker was Marquis de Condorcet, and he lived from 1744 through until 1794, and he was very influential during the Enlightenment, and he contributed significantly to the rise of secular humanism. And I would say he planted a number of seeds that eventually would grow up to be transhumanism. And he said and is considered to have best represented the ideals of the Enlightenment. And to this end, he would advocate for such things as a liberal economy, free and equal public education, constitutionalism, those concepts. He also advocated, like many of his peers, for the primacy of reason, and he saw it as a way to liberate humanity from the church, authoritarianism, and nature itself, which is an interesting, I guess, distinction to make. Something that a number of transhumanists today are on board is how and in what ways does nature and do natural, so-called natural autonomous processes constrain us and dictate our condition? And in what ways can we overcome that? He was also a brilliant mathematician and a political scientist. And in fact, he forged the two disciplines together, and he became the first person in history to effectively use mathematical principles to study social science. And again, now when you, the synergy or the interdisciplinary cross analysis is very common, and one wouldn't even think perhaps of studying various aspects of, let's say, social science without having some kind of um, proper science and mathematics behind it. So very much ahead of his time, or you know, very much perhaps the right place at the right time in terms of understanding how these sorts of things should be applied. He also speculated about utopian possibilities, and to that effect, he wrote a piece on the perfectibility of society. Now, he gave no actual real concrete definition of what he meant by a perfect human existence, but he did believe that the progression of the human race would inevitably continue throughout the course of its existence. He was very much a proponent or a believer in perpetual progress, so long as we would continue to apply scientific and rational frameworks to our condition and to our technological and scientific development, and of course in turn and how it applies to society. And interestingly, his thoughts prompted Thomas Malthus to write his famous paper on unsustainable population growth. But his most influential work from a transhumanist perspective was his work entitled Sketch for a Historical Picture of the Progress of the Human Mind, which he wrote when he was in hiding after the French Revolution, and actually this book was published posthumously. In this book, he argued that reason and science can and should be applied to better develop humanity's intellectual and moral faculties. He thought that all facets of nature should be reevaluated and conformed to the needs of human intelligence. And I'll quote, if you'll allow me, I'll quote Marquis de Condorcet. The time will therefore come when the sun will shine only on free men who know no other master but their reason, when tyrants and slaves, priests and their stupid or hypocritical instruments will exist only in works of history and on the stage, and when we shall think of them only to pity their victims and their dupes, to maintain ourselves in a state of vigilance by thinking on their excesses, and to learn how to recognize and so to destroy by force of reason the first seeds of tyranny and superstition, should they ever dare to reappear among us. And again, that's a great quote from Condorcet. And he pinpointed a number of factors that he thought were responsible for the various inequalities and injustices that inflicted humanity. And this list included, you know, your standard fare, disparities in wealth, status, and education. But of interest to transhumanists and life extensionists, he also thought that our finite and rather limited length of life was also one of these inequalities, or rather an influential force that was responsible for inequalities and the injustice that inflicted humans. So yeah, he was an early advocate of life extension, and he didn't see any reason why it shouldn't be a part of humanity's inexorable path towards perfectibility. And I'll read you another quote. The real advantages that should result from this progress, of which we can entertain a hope, is that most certainly can have no other term than that of the absolute perfection of the human race, since as the various kinds of equality come to work in its favor by producing ampler sources of supply, more extensive education, more complete liberty, so equality will be more real and will embrace everything which is really of importance for the happiness of human beings. There's quite obviously a lot more about Marquis de Condorcet on the internet, and if this was something of interest to you, I highly encourage that you read up on him. And I'd like to talk about, not today, but perhaps the next podcast, Denis Diderot, who's another great proto-transhumanist and Enlightenment thinker. And again, these very seminal thinkers who we owe a lot to in terms of some of our ideas now as it pertains to human enhancement, and again, how we can perhaps use science and technology to further democratize ourselves, to further liberate ourselves, to alleviate a lot of the suffering and inequalities that goes on. And as Condorcet wrote, to really take a firm grasp on those things that are important to the happiness of human beings. So there you have it, Marquis de Condorcet, Enlightenment thinker extraordinaire and proto-transhumanist. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to end the show with one last topic, a rather non-futuristic and rather non-transhumanistic topic. I'm going to talk about Britney Spears, of all people. And why should you care? Why should I care? Why should anybody care about some spoiled multimillionaire singer who can't seem to get her act together, who seems to be neglecting her kids and neglecting her life, and certainly appears to be headed in a bad way to some kind of, you know, self-destruction of some sort? Well, I mean, part of my my overall worldview and big picture here is not strictly. I'm most certainly not all about the transhumanism and the futurism and the hard science and you know, what's even been called the religion of science. But I do try as much as possible to put a human element in all these things. And as many of you know as well, I'm a practicing Buddhist, and I very much look at how Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist ideas can certainly work to contribute to my life and to give me perhaps an enlightened perspective on myself and my relationships. So there's a spiritual element to the different things that I do and how I think things through. And I think this is no exception when it comes to our appraisal of celebrities and how we relate and associate to celebrities. Because let's face it, celebrities are pretty important to a lot of us, and we like to follow the tabloids and follow on what, you know, many of these people are doing and how they're doing it. And for many of us, it can be a bit of Schadenfreude. We seem to love to watch people suffer, particularly those people who are more successful than we are. But in this particular case, and what really got me thinking about this, about Britney, was the recent death, the shocking death of Heath Ledger. And while I realized that Ledger's death was likely not a suicide, that's the jury still out on that, but clearly the man did not have his life together, and he certainly was abusing substances such that, well, he's no longer with us anymore. But it did get me thinking that just because of the shock and the disappointment and the sadness that was associated with Ledger's death, it immediately got me thinking that any day now, quite sadly, we could be opening up the papers in the morning to see that Britney Spears had met a similar fate. And how are we going to feel about that when it actually happens? And my point in all this, and I'm kind of, I guess, evading really the ultimate point of this little rant here, is that I would like to see, you know, I think myself included, but to see us have a bit of a healthier attitude when it comes to mental health, and even more particularly in regards to those people that suffer from such things as depression, or in the case of Britney Spears, what certainly appears to be manic depression. That when it happens to a celebrity, and maybe even an acquaintance or somebody that we know, a friend of a friend, there is that sort of tee-hee aspect to it, that even that sort of indifference about the whole thing, that, oh, well, you can't do anything about, you know, somebody who's manic depressive or depressed, there's probably, you know, let's just sweep it under the carpet and forget about it and not deal with it, which is a completely different attitude than we would have if, let's say, somebody informed us that they had something like cancer or some very obvious or tangible medical condition that perhaps could be treated with a bit more efficacy. That for some reason, when it's somebody's mental health that's involved, it's all right to either poke fun of it or to ignore it. And that's, in my mind, completely unacceptable. I mean, if we had heard news that Britney had some kind of chronic disease, I'm sure we wouldn't have the same amount of disdain for her in the media as we do. And that's ultimately my point. And I did blog about this. For those of you who read my blog, I'm sure you saw that post. And I had a number of people write to me complaining, oh, why are you wasting your time on your blog discussing a celebrity, that there are more important things to be concerned about, and most certainly that we shouldn't be concerned about this particular person who's spoiled and rich and is a celebrity and doesn't deserve our sympathies, and that we should much rather be focusing on the starving children of Africa. And my response to these things is that, you know, we actually have to care about both the starving children of Africa and we have to care about Britney Spears. And in fact, the sentiment that you only care about the kids of Africa and not Britney Spears is actually bullshit, because clearly you don't really care about any of these things, just whatever you happen to feel at that given time who you think you should care for. And if your level of compassion is not meted out and distributed across the board and unconditionally, then I question really the kind of devotion you have for other people and other things, which is my way of also kind of circumventing back to here that basically says that how we feel about our celebrities is very much emblematic of how we feel about others, particularly those that we're not that close to. Obviously, we have a family member that's suffering from these things. We might be a bit more inclined to deal with it. But when it's somebody that is outside our social circle, a friend of a friend, or in this case, a celebrity, that the distance there enables us to detach ourselves and at that point to be able to poke fun and even exert a bit of schadenfreude at them. So my point is that, you know, if you can't exert a certain amount of compassion and sympathy for somebody like Britney and worry about her health and worry about her future, then I really question your overall attitude towards a whole lot of other different things. So there's me, you know, I think in a former life, I must have been, you know, that was awfully sermon-like, wasn't it? I could just, you know, imagine some minister standing in front of the podium there addressing his congregation having a very similar speech. And I don't know what that means for me to talk about it like that. Hopefully I don't sound like I'm coming across as being holier than thou. But I do have my moments where I feel I need to kind of get it out and rant a little bit. It helps me articulate my thoughts and my own sense of compassion and morality. So I would love to hear your feedback, actually. And just drop me a line on either email or on my blog post itself. And my email is easy to remember. It's george@betterhumans.com. So am I right about all this? Am I wrong? Am I off the mark? Should we not care about celebrities? And am I making too much of this? Would certainly value your opinions on that. Okay, so that ends today's podcast. Once again, thank you for joining me today and listening to the Ascension Developments audiocast. Like I said, I'm back on track with doing these. I can't promise you how often I will do these, but certainly my goal is for once a week. And much of the reason for me doing this again was I was receiving a number of emails and requests for me to restart this up again. So it's wonderful to get feedback and to be motivated by that. Otherwise, sometimes you get the feeling that you're doing this and nobody is listening or that nobody even cares. So please keep the pod. If you like the podcast, let me know. And if you don't, well, then you might want to keep it to yourself, because then I'll just probably, you know, be unmotivated to keep doing it. But feedback is always great, and both positive and negative. I only joke when I say that. And I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll look for you next time around. Bye-bye.